Lil Ray, to have you back on. And let's get started with the U.S. foreign policy and the most important challenges that they're facing right now. And you've sent me a link to Scott Ritter's article, which is so important. I've just read it. It's so important. So it's amazing how he put out the title is the On a Highway to Hell. And I think the foreign policy of the United States is facing huge challenges when it comes to Ukraine, when it comes to the conflict in Taiwan and in the Middle East. How do you find it, Ray?
Well, let's start off with the nuclear issue. I think that's obviously the most urgent one. Scott's piece is very meticulous in tracing how Joe Biden initially promised that, look, we had enough nuclear forces arrayed against any enemy, and that we didn't need to do much more. That's before he was president. And then when he came in, he was persuaded by whom? Well, by the people who make the missiles and make all the other things, the military industrial complex, that no, we have to prepare for not only a fight against Russia, but against China as well, and North Korea as well. Suffice it to say that whether Biden wanted it or not, it happened. And now they are building up to the point where they have plans to make enough weaponry to contend with both Russia and China and North Korea. And that's a difference in kind. Now, a difference also in kind is the kind of sophistication that Ted Postol, for example, has pointed out, how these missiles can be fine-tuned to such a point that they're twice as accurate, and in some cases, twice as penetrating as the old ones that I was accustomed to, you know, the SS-8s and the ICBMs, the Minutemen. So, as we look at this with considerable disquiet, the Russians are looking at it also in the same vein, and the Chinese as well, and of course the North Koreans. A footnote here, North Koreans have the next to the most sophisticated ICBM produced by the Russians, and nobody went to acknowledge that. A year and 3 months ago, Jacob Sullivan was asked at one of his press conferences, well, what about this new missile that really is a Soviet or Russian missile, and now it's appeared in North Korea with all kinds of capabilities to strike anywhere in the U.S. with very, very sophisticated penetrating mechanism and shaft and everything. What about that? And he said, oh, we're aware of that report, and our intelligence people are looking into it. Well, apparently our press has been told, don't ask any more about that, because nobody has asked any more about that. And our intelligence people, and Ted Postol, of course, is in touch with many of the, at least the retired folks, they haven't said a word one. So that's the North Korean aspect of that. It's important. I mean, after all, in the interim, the Russians signed a mutual defense treaty with North Korea. Yeah, that surprised everyone, including me. So we have these things. Then we have trade journals, which are very close to the Pentagon, you know. But one of the most recent ones here, I printed it out because it's so indicative of the kind of thinking, not only by the military-industrial complex, but by the Pentagon people, retired or doctors, professors, PhDs working for them. The title says, the U.S. bomber fleet. Now, we're not talking about missiles, we're talking about the bomber fleet, which is one of the foots of the triad here. You have missiles on ICBMs, land-based, then you have sea-based missiles. And then you have the bombers. Now, when Trump was asked about that, Billy was campaigning way back in 2016. He didn't seem to know what triad meant, but that's what it means, okay? Bombers have always been a key ingredient here, okay? And they have to be ready, because if they're not ready, they get blown away on their airfields, okay? So here are two defense-related industry guys, actually a retired lieutenant colonel and a PhD who is very much involved here. U.S. bomber fleet has been off alert since 1991. Who took it off alert? George W. Bush. One might ask why. Well, the Soviet Union just imploded, for God's sake, you know. But this is not good for the military-industrial complex. It's time to go back to a Cold War posture, argue these two authors, okay? Not only these two authors, but a congressman from California, Garamundi, Democrat. I'd like to know how much money he gets from the military-industrial complex. What he says is, look, I challenge the military to return nuclear bombers to an alert status so that if there's a nuclear alert, as serious as STRATCOM is telling me, that we're ready. Otherwise, it could take a cold day or several days to get into alert status, and we have to be ready right away. Now, they always point it in terms of deterrent, right? We're going to deter a Russian attack. But as Scott points out, you know, there are a lot of, well, I call them not quite compass mentis. There are a lot of Air Force generals and so forth who think they can win a nuclear war. And that's the danger that the Russians have to see as well. In any case, this is how this fellow comes through. He says, look, we have to get back to alert status because even if the Air Force can't keep that up for more than a day or two, our 47 nuclear-capable B-52s and our 19 nuclear-capable B-2 bombers are sitting like ducks for a strike against us. So, but hey, bombers. Bombers haven't really been mentioned very much. The underwater Trident submarines that we have, and that the Russians have the equivalent, are one formidable object which usually serves as a deterrent. So all I'm saying is the Russians are looking on at this. And they come from, you know, not too many decades ago, where they had, and we had devised a way to have what was then called mutual assured destruction. MAD for short. Now, you can call it MAD, but it was sensible. And the key to that was an anti-ballistic missile treaty, which limited the number of anti-ballistic missile systems that each country could have to two, right? And then after a year or two, to one, because it didn't matter. There was no chance that either side, the Russians or we, could count on being able to make a preemptive strike and not be destroyed because there were no anti-ballistic missiles. That was key. I worked on that. I was chief of the branch that advised Kissinger and Nixon on that. And we, CIA at large, were able to verify it to make sure that the Russians didn't cheat. A little codicil here. Did they cheat? Yeah, they cheated. What happened? 1987, we discovered in imagery an incredible radar up in a place called Krasnoyarsk in the middle of Siberia. My God, nothing else was around it. And it was clearly an ABM radar prohibited by the treaty. It was one in addition to the one that was permitted around Moscow. So we called the Russians on it. And of course, they said, oh, no, it's not an ABM derivative. Then Gorbachev came in, and Reagan developed a relationship with him. And he said, look, Gorbachev, that's an ABM radar. Will you tear it down? And Gorbachev went to his military and says, is that an ABM treaty? Yeah, this is bully, yeah, it is. Okay, we're going to tear it down. And they did. Lesson there, took about 6 or 7 years to negotiate all this, but finally somebody with some sense came in. They tore that thing down. Well, long story short, I came away from Moscow in May of 1972, buoyant, like a little boy, actually. You know, I was one of those people that hid under desks in the 50s and 60s, not 60s, but the 50s. And, you know, the whole notion that we were deterred, each side was deterred from doing this terrible thing, was such a wonderful thing, actually, not only to experience, but to have had some small role in, right? So then what does George W. Bush do when he comes in? Well, John Bolton says, I get rid of that treaty. And so Bush says, okay, we'll get rid of the treaty. That was 2002, 1972, 30 years of strategic stability, okay? Now, Scott Ritter, who wrote this piece that you referred to, it's on Consortium News for those who are interested. It just appeared today on my screen. He was involved in something equally important, and that is the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty. Now, a little background on that, how that came about. Gorbachev and Reagan had a measure of trust in those days. And Gorbachev says to Reagan, look, you've got these Pershing 2 missiles in Europe capable of striking me and everybody else in 10 minutes or so. Yeah, we've got these SS-20s capable of striking you in Berlin and Paris and London in 20 minutes, in 10 minutes or so. And we also have these ICBMs and these sea-launched ballistic missiles and these bombers that can do it in half an hour. Let's get rid of the ones that do it in 10 minutes. Reagan came to us and he says, is he serious? And I said, well, I didn't think it would ever happen. I said, well, try it out, you know? Well, he tried it. And it was concluded in 1987, okay? Now, what was Scott's role? He was in the Soviet Union at the time, and he was the first one on site at a god-awful place called Votkinsk, way the hell up in northern Siberia, where they were making the most dangerous long-range ICBM missiles. And he was entrusted, together with his Russian counterparts, to destroy those missiles. Yeah, not to put them away somewhere in storage, but to destroy them, okay? And he spent 2 years doing that, okay? And they were destroyed. And the warning time went back up from 10 minutes to 30 minutes, okay? Now, and there was still some nuclear deterrence, even though the ABM treaty had been, by then, 2002, nixed. So that's why Scott feels so strongly about that. There were all kinds of pressures from the military-industrial complex on Scott and all the other inspectors and the whole regime that was created to monitor and verify that these things had been destroyed. And Scott was very ingenious, as usual, in constructing ways that were foolproof, that could show to any dissident, anybody kind of say, well, no, this is that the Russians really aren't doing that, to make sure that they had no case. And, you know, I dare say when you're involved, you know, I wasn't in Moscow for 2 years. Scott was in Votkinsk for 3 years, right? When you have that kind of experience and you feel that you have actually destroyed a whole class, and that's what it was, a whole class of nuclear missiles in place. I mean, they were installed, they were ready to shoot, they were nuclear warheads close by. So that's why we all feel very strongly about this. Now, what's happened now? There are two things that are happening now. The one that we started out with, namely, Biden, whether he wanted to or not, was forced to accommodate to these grandiose plans to enhance the accuracy and enhance the number of the kind of missiles that were prohibited by these other treaties. Now, there is still one treaty in force, but that runs out, I think, next year, or maybe 2026. Anyhow, that's really much up in the air here, and that's what Scott is saying. Our planners, these Air Force guys and these Navy guys have actually openly said, you know, we can pretty much, we use these little tactical nukes. Some of these sea-launched ballistic missiles on Ohio-class submarines, you know, Trident missiles are the long-range ones. They have little nukes now. They have sort of mini nukes that are, they're just a little bigger than the ones that destroyed Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Huh? Yeah, they're little ones. Okay, give me a break. So the whole thing is very volatile, especially in these days. And on the other side, the Russians are saying, well, look, you know, you keep talking about inflicting a defeat on Russia. You openly acknowledge that that's what this Ukraine thing is all about, that you're using them. Well, you don't say you're using them as proxies, but that's what it is. It's a 500,000 Ukrainian, flower of Ukrainian boyhood are dead now. So you're using them, and we're up to your game, and we're not going to let you do that. And by the way, you know, this business of going into Kursk, well, welcome. We're going to destroy every last one of you that went into Kursk. What are you trying to do? Well, what they're trying to do, in my view, Lima, and this is probably controversial, but what Zelensky is trying to do is mousetrap Biden in his last 2 months. I mean, well, it's got 4 months, but 2 months before the election, mousetrap him into doing something in reaction to what the Russians are provoked into doing, and that would change things around in such a way that Ukraine would not go down the tube before the election. And I've talked about that before. This might include these little mini nukes. You know, they're on the shelf there. Why don't we use them rather than lose the war, lose the election, lose our freedom if Trump wins and goes after us? So that's part of it, okay? The other part is trying to educate the Europeans. I mean, Europeans have never been so, naive, never have been led by political hacks to the extent they are now. Here is Scholz in Berlin, right? Chancellor of Germany. And he says he negotiates with the United States to employ Pershing 2 type missiles and worse in Germany. Well, they just start in 2026, and they're going to. And the agreement, the bilateral agreement, they couldn't get all of NATO to agree to this, although it was announced at the NATO summit. The bilateral agreement talks about long range nuclear missiles. Long range. Well, long range in Germany? Why does Germany need long range ballistic missiles? Now, the discussion talks about medium and short range missiles, like the INF treaty I mentioned before, but the agreement says long range. That hasn't been sorted out yet. I haven't been able to get any answer to why they say long range. But here it is, Germany accepting this. And when Scholz was asked about this, you know, sometimes the Germans have a reporter that asks relevant questions. And this reporter said, well, what's that all about? And Scholz said, well, the Americans decided this would be a good idea, and we agreed. Okay, now, what are the Russians trying to do? They're trying to say to all the Europeans, look, isn't it enough that the U.S. is allowed to use Ukraine in an attempt to weaken Russia? Do you have any doubt that that's the ultimate aim? Well, look what the Defense Secretary Austin said in the U.S. that they're saying the whole name of the game is to weaken Russia. Okay, now, we're not going to be weakened. Actually, we're winning quite handily in Ukraine. So what's the next step? Are they going to use you? Are they going to put more missiles in your area and then try to get us to retaliate and do it that way? Well, you know, the whole business of these intermediate range ballistic missiles and the long range are the ones that apparently are going to be put in Germany in a couple of years, is completely unnecessary for Europe's defense, okay, in my view, okay? The reason that we hadn't been prepared for a war with Russia is because Russia was no threat to us. And that's why we had no 155 millimeter shells, for example, basic armament. So what Russia is trying to do is to say to the Germans and the French and all the Europeans, look, you see what's happened to Ukraine. Do you want the same thing to happen to you? Because let's say you let F-16s, these nuclear-capable F-16s, fly out of your airfields in Poland or Romania. There are people in Washington that want us Russians to attack those air bases so that you, in turn, can invoke Article 5 of the NATO Charter and say, well, now we're at war with Russia. Okay. Now, is that what you really want? Okay. Do you think, and this is what they've said in pretty clear terms, the Russians, do you think that Washington, its leaders, are prepared to sacrifice or to risk New York or Washington for Kiev or for Odessa or for any place in Europe? Do you think they would? And that's a powerful argument, because unless you say U.S. policymakers are completely out of their minds, let's hope that that's not the case. There's a very powerful argument that the Russians can use with the Europeans, saying, look, you know, we have these small nuclear weapons too. So if the U.S. tries to use one of these things to show how powerful it is, we have them too, okay? And we're not going to fire them at Washington and New York right at the outset. You know where we're going to fire them? So why don't you come to your senses and let's work out a deal on Ukraine before it comes to that? Now, that's why the Russians are saying, look, we're revising our nuclear doctrine. We'll make it a little bit more specific, exactly what would trigger a nuclear response for us. But I see that immediately aimed at Europe, not at the United States. Although, you know, Lavrov and the others have said, look, you know, those two oceans that you were able to hide behind during World War II, forget about it. Now it's very different. And indeed, it is different. Last thing I'll say on this is that when the U.S. rejected Putin's offer to cooperate, is, you know, in the years after he came in 2000, he said, well, okay, all right, we can't work a deal. We're going to just have to build a kind of arsenal that will make us impregnable. And we're not going to waste our money on anti-ballistic missile systems because that's a joke. They don't work, not with today's technology, not with all the stuff that we have that can get around anti-ballistic missile defenses. So we're going to build things like hypersonic missiles and missiles that go around the South Pole. Okay, and he had a slideshow, for God's sake, at the State of the Nation address a couple of years ago. Putin ran this little slideshow showing what they had. Prepared and were coming online. And then he finally said, now will you listen? Now will you listen? And what he got back was, no, we're going to make a war. We're going to make it possible for Ukraine to become part of NATO. And that is a casus belli, as was told us many years ago. The last thing I'll say is that our policymakers are not very bright. There are people who are very bright around. John Mearsheimer is one. You've had him on your program. I asked John Mearsheimer 2 years ago or so. I was asking him a question at a public forum. I said, John, you were right on Ukraine. You said, well, now it's 10 years ago, in the prestigious journal Foreign Affairs, that if the U.S. pursues a policy of trying to get Ukraine into NATO, that will end up in the destruction of Ukraine. and that will be the fault of the West. Now, Ukraine is being widely destructed now, if you will, okay? Now, tell me, John, I asked, has anyone in the administration, in view of all this, have they asked to talk to you, or you're in Washington frequently, do they ever call you up and say, hey, John, we'd like to have a conversation, you know? They don't have to admit that you were right and they were wrong, but you know, don't they want to talk to you? He said, Ray, not once has anyone in the United States government tried to get in contact with me. Now, that speaks volumes, because back in the day, we had all kinds of academics, all kinds of specialists that we invited in, you know, people who didn't agree with us, people who thought this or that, the other thing. We want to hear what they said, and we want to see the evidence they adduced for coming to their conclusions. Not anymore. So it's a closed loop. It's Blinken and Sullivan, neither of whom know much about war, know much about strategic opportunities or strategic threats.
Ray, with what's going on right now in the European Union, especially in Germany, having AfD and the situation, the position that they're having right now, do you think that that would change the mindset of Europeans, or are we going to have the same kind of mindset as we had all these more than 2 years?
I didn't hear the first part of your question. What were you referring to going on in Germany now?
Yeah, in Germany. My question is this going to influence the mindset of Europeans, and particularly in Germany, the foreign policy of Germany, mm-hmm. and how they're going to deal with the conflict in Ukraine in terms of their relationship with the United States, and how capable are they to force, to push the United States foreign policy to change its manner toward Ukraine?
Well, the Germans have shown themselves to be lapdogs. They do whatever they're told. Witness the story I just adduced with respect to, well, Washington decided to put these long-range missiles in Germany, and we said, oh, we agreed, okay? So I don't see much coming from the Germans are up against it. The elections in Thuringia and Saxony, or just the last couple of days, show that the AfD is gaining a lot of traction. The Ampel, the three red, white, and blue people in the parties in the Berlin government are coming out short on all these things, even behind the Christian Democrats. So they have a lot to contend with. I don't know how long Scholz is going to be able to hang in there. But you know, the European leadership, such as sort of gravitated toward the top, has shown itself unwilling or unable to challenge the U.S. And when you come right down to it, it's the people who make a lot of money on building the weapons, the people who are influenced financially, that have this clout with Scholz as well as clout in Washington. And that's really, you know, if you look at how Biden, what Scott doesn't actually mention, but it's obvious, that why did Biden change his mind? You know, he was very sensible coming in, and maybe those arguments led to his victory. You know, there's no need to rev up our nuclear deterrent posture. What happened? Well, he got in, and those people that really have the influence in Washington took Joe aside and said, now, Joe, it's just the way it works. Yeah, we can build these really, really smart bombs. They only cost X billion, and they'll make it real. That'll be a real, real deterrent. Well, you know, there's a thin line between a real, real deterrent like that and an offensive capability, a first strike capability that the Russians have to be very afraid of. So, again, I would distinguish between what they're afraid of in a general sense in terms of this arms race now that the U.S. has decided to take on Russia, China, North Korea, all together, more missiles, more like more profits for the military-industrial complex. I distinguish that from the situation on the ground in the next 2 months before the election in Ukraine. And people are thinking that, Washington or New York or of our targets for what the Russians might do, not for the next 2 months, maybe 2 years from now. Right now, the Russians are saying, look, we have the kind of nuclear capability, and we have exercised it, and we have exercised it with Belarus right there in your backyard. So we have them too. Don't even think of letting the U.S. to avoid a definitive retreat or definitive defeat in Ukraine. Don't even think of letting them think that it's okay to explode just one of these smaller things. Yeah, give me a break. That's as Scott Ritter said, that's Armageddon. That leads to the end of all of us. And one of the problems is that Scott's not as old as I am, but Scott's getting up there, and he and I both know what it was like when there was mad mutual assured destruction, and when we were able to breathe easy when neither side could even think of having a first strike without having immediate retaliation and destruction. And not many people thought about these little mini nukes, so they were the new thing, okay? But they're armed on our submarines now, for God's sake, on our ballistic missile submarines, as well as the Typhoon class submarines. So, yeah, it's complicated, but the nuclear issue has raised its head. Both sides seem to be refining their nuclear posture statements, but hopefully, people like Scott and others can get enough people educated to realize that this is really playing with fire. And maybe, just maybe the thought occurs to me that maybe that's why they really hate Scott. That's why. Does the military industrial complex run the FBI as well? No, I don't think so. Maybe just the Department of Justice, which runs the FBI, I mean, hello. He's a spokesman for, he knows more than most other people about this area. I say he probably knows more than anybody. And now he's still free to put this stuff out there and show how dangerous it is. And he won't be deterred. And I just hope that they cease and desist and that they don't make up things to make it seem like he's an agent of Russia.
Larry, when it comes to Ray, sorry, when it comes to the influence coming from the European Union on the United States foreign policy, which country, Ray, in Europe is most important? Many people are arguing that the United Kingdom is much powerful comparing to other countries. But I've talked with British diplomats, they're not thinking this way. They're thinking that whatever the United States tries to do, they just force it on the foreign policy of the United Kingdom, and they're not capable of opposing any sort of policy coming out of the United States. Do you think that, as people, many people are thinking, do they have any sort of influence on the foreign policy, United Kingdom, on the foreign policy of the United States?
It's a good question, Nima, like all your questions. I think they have some influence, they've had it for a long time. I don't think it's a determinative. In other words, the U.S. is going to do what it wants to do, but when you have Big Brother, the English, who have been around for a really long time, putting their arm around you and saying, now this is the way you do things here, this is the way an empire is supposed to act. We know we were an empire one time. I think back to 1953. The CIA was a fledgling operation here. And what happens? Mossadegh, the first popularly democratically elected leader of Iran in three millennia, is elected. And then he looks at the poor Iranians. He said, I think we should have a better share of the profits from the oil that's under our ground here. So he challenged the British Petroleum, whatever it was in those days. And then he said, we'd like to work out a deal. Then the British took the CIA around the shoulder. Now, this is what you do with an upstart like most of that kind of third-rate country like Iran thinks that the oil under their soil belongs to them. And, of course, we had the first notable regime change operation. And look at the fallout for that. From that, for God's sake, that was 1953. All right. Anyhow, the British have had this influence all along. It's less now than it was in 1953. We've learned a lot of lessons from the British. And, you know, we're not going to be an empire that just falls apart. God, I hope we're going to fall apart. I hope we fall apart as relatively peaceably as the British did. But that's up in arms now because there are lots of people building these arms and just trying to make sure that that they keep threatening whoever is next in line. And they bit off a little too much when they decided to challenge Russia in Ukraine. And I'm just going to mention one more time, Nima, that Obama himself in 2015 warned. He said, look, we have to be really careful about what we choose to go to war for. Our national interests, our core interests, there are none in Ukraine. Okay, Russians? Well, the Russians have core interests in Ukraine. Look at the map, okay? And so, continued Obama, the worst thing we can do for the Ukrainians is to give them the idea that they can prevail in war against a much stronger Russia. Now, that made sense at the time. Joe Biden was his vice president. I don't know what changed his mind. Probably the same kinds of people that changed his mind about enhancing his nuclear deterrent capabilities. But, you know, he was pretty malleable on all this stuff. And Blinken at the time, and mark this is worth repeating as well, Blinken, who was Deputy Secretary of State at the time, said, Mr. Vice President, you're absolutely right. Or Mr. President, and he's talking about Obama. Yeah, Mr. President. Because, you know, whatever we do, if we were to, Obama refused to provide offensive weaponry to Ukraine. That's the background on all this. So Tony Blinken, Deputy Secretary of State, says, yeah, that makes very good sense because this is a quote, anything we gave the Ukrainians, the Russians could match and then double and then quadruple. So it's not a good idea. 2015. So then Biden comes in. Blinken's all of a sudden the Secretary of State. And what do? They go for arms in Ukraine. Why? Obviously, to challenge Russia, to hope against hope that Putin will lose power. I mean, these people are not really bright. And not only that, they're really dangerous because they don't know which end is up. They've never worn a military uniform. They don't know much about strategic implications. I think they've been the worst foreign policy team that we've had since Vietnam. And there are similarities there, Nima. I have to say that these people come out of the same fancy schools, have the same well-polished shoes as the ones that got us into Vietnam. You name them. They came from Harvard. They came from Yale. Just like these guys, Ivy Leaguers. And Halberstam wrote a book about him. He called the book The Best and the Brightest. And those are the ones that had this exceptional attitude that these little bare brown feet running through the jungle couldn't possibly cope with the United States. Well, they learned a lesson, but not really, because these new crop is in, and they're learning this lesson all over again. This time, they're confronted. They bit off much more than they can chew. I'm really worried, as you know, about the next 2 months and what these people might be tempted to do to avoid complete defeat in Ukraine, because Kursk is not going well. And worse than that, the people the good troops that the Ukrainians had, experienced troops, well-armed troops to NATO standards, really, they're being captured and killed in Kursk and not able to help the ones that are left defending the big long line, what's it, 800 kilometers or so, where the Russians are having more success. As a matter of fact, I think Putin said today at some high school, he said, you know, we're going so fast against the Ukrainians in the east there, in the Donbass, we're going twice as fast as we usually go. Well, that seems to be the case. Why? Because there are no reinforcements, there's no reserve, and the danger is that the U.S. will try to do something to prevent that, something eye-catching, and I have no assurance that Biden, Blinken and Sullivan wouldn't choose a small mini nuke if Biden were asleep and they had the codes to the nuclear arsenal.
Ray, shifting the gears to the conflict in Gaza, Benjamin Netanyahu, he's saying that we are very close to eliminating Hamas. And do you see any sign of that they're going to win, or they're going to eliminate, to remove Hamas from Gaza?
No. Even one very senior Israeli military official has admitted you can't beat the Hamas. It's an idea. I mean, it is an idea. It's an idea that springs from people trying to claw back control of their homeland. You know, we did it way back 2.5 centuries ago when we clawed back a homeland for ourselves against the British imperialists, okay? So it's happened many times. And when people think, well, why are the Hamas, why are they so popular in Gaza? Well, up until now, it was not so much because they were hitting an Israeli every now and then. They were running the hospitals, okay? They were feeding the poor, okay? They were adhering to, well, you probably know better than I, Nima, the Muslim ethic that you take care of the poor and you do what you can to advance their wholeness. That's why they won the election that Condoleezza Rice insisted on back in 2005. They won hands down. Why? Because compared to the Palestinian Authority, you know, the Palestinian Authority, as corrupt as could be, in league with the Israelis in many cases. So they won hands down, and look what they're suffering because they won hands down. Now, I don't condone killing, okay? But you try to understand why Hamas would have done what they did on October 7th. And it's the same, you know, let me just say this, okay? It's the same reasoning. When you're up against it, okay, when you see day-to-day infringement on liberties and worse, being put in prison for nothing, just kept in prison like thousands of Palestinians in Israeli jails, well, you think of really dastardly things to do in return. And when I talk about 9/11 and why Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the mastermind of 9/11, would have done what he arranged, what he did. You know, the answer is on page 154 of the 9/11 Commission report. He didn't decide this out of the blue. He was asked, why did you do this, by interrogators before the 9/11 Commission wrote its report. And I know some of those people who were interrogating, people working on the report. So they said, now look, did you suffer some indignity when you got your engineering degree from University of North Carolina, Greensboro? I mean, did people call you a towel head? Did you have an affair of the heart? Why do you hate us so much? He says, it's very easy. I did it because of the one-sided support of the United States for the atrocities of the state of Israel. That's why I did it. And the people writing the 9/11 report had enough guts to put a little footnote down there. And the footnote goes down and says, oh, this is what Khalid Sheikh Mohammed's nephew, Ramzi Youssef, said when he tried to blow up the one of the Twin Towers, at least, back in 1993 or so. When he was sentenced, he said, I'm glad I did it, and I did it because I needed to do something to retaliate for the Israeli infractions against my people and against the other people. Okay, so you know, when you do these things, you pay a price. And this is not to justify what happened on the 7th of October, but it's to say it should not have come as a surprise because of all, you know, I've been there. I've been in the West Bank, and I've been all over that place three times. And I could see how the Palestinians were living and how the Israelis were living. And it was a dichotomy that is really hard to countenance. And when the rabbi in charge of one settlement that we visited up on high on a hill there, pristine white walls and, you know, grass being watered, lawns being watered, were down at the bottom, the Palestinians had no running water, for God's sake. We asked them, but friend of me, he says, though, why do you have this kind of paradise up here when others are suffering? And he says, well, look, God promised this. It's right there. I mean, we promised the promised land. It's Deuteronomy 15:4. Read it. You could see God promises this land. Now, Nima, I don't know the Hebrew scriptures all that well, but I did know, thank goodness, Deuteronomy 15:4. And so I said to this rabbi, who is from Cleveland, by the way, Jewish rabbi from Cleveland, head of the settler community up here, I said, Rabbi, why did you only read the first half of Deuteronomy 15:4? He said, what do you mean? I said, you have the Bible right there. Read the whole thing. Well, this is an exact translation, but he says, the Lord said you should have this land of milk and honey so that there will be no poor among you. And I said, oh, so it was a deal, was it? Yeah, the kind of you Jewish people had a deal with God. It sounded like, well, you could call it a covenant, huh? So you can have this land so that there can be no poor among you, like the people that doesn't parse. Well, the conversation went downhill after that, Nima, and we were we had to shorten our visit to this wonderful, beautiful, grass-watered, well-watered. It was really despicable to see how those settlers were living in comparison to what the Palestinians were encountering at the bottom of the hill.
Yeah. Ray, when it comes to the 2024 presidential election in the United States, there are people out there thinking that the foreign policy of the Democratic Party, Kamala Harris, going to be different from the one of Donald Trump and the Republican Party. And when it comes to Gaza and Israel, here is the answer of Kamala Harris on CNN. She gave an interview talking about the foreign policy of the United States in Israel.
Biden has tried unsuccessfully to end the war between Israel and Hamas in Gaza. He's been doing it for months and months, along with you. Would you do anything differently? For example, would you withhold some U.S. weapons shipments to Israel? That's what a lot of people on the progressive left want you to do.
Let me be very clear. I am unequivocal and unwavering in my commitment to Israel's defense and its ability to defend itself. And that's not going to change. But let's take a step back. October 7, 1,200 people were massacred. Many young people who were simply attending a music festival. Women were horribly raped. As I said then, I say today, Israel has a right to defend itself, we would. And how it does so matters. far too many innocent Palestinians have been killed. And we have got to get a deal done. We were in Doha. Mm-hmm. We have to get a deal done. This war must end.
In the meantime.
And we must get a deal that is about getting the hostages out. I've met with the families of the American hostages. Let's get the hostages out. Let's get the ceasefire done.
But no change in policy in terms of arms and so forth.
No, we have to get a deal done. Dana, we have to get a deal done. When you look at the significance of this to the families, to the people who are living in that region, a deal is not only the right thing to do to end this war, but will unlock so much of what must happen next. I remain committed since I've been on October 8 to what we must do to work toward a two-state solution, where Israel is secure and in equal measure the Palestinians have security and self-determination and dignity.
Yeah.
Nima, crocodile tears come to mind. Can't read my notes here, but you know, two-state solution. Forget about a two-state solution. Not going to happen. The Palestinians and the Israelis are, in the end analysis, and I hope I live to this long, have to learn how to live together. Okay. Now, when I talk about crocodile tears, I also talk about disingenuousness. Okay. We have to get a deal. Okay. What is preventing a deal? Netanyahu is preventing a deal. Why is he preventing a deal? Because we are arming his arms, his army and air force and all that, so that there can be no deal as long as he continues to wage this war against the Gazans and now against the Palestinians in the West Bank. So, Kamala, is there anything that could stop this carnage so that we could have a deal? Yeah, there is. You could get on the phone, or Uncle Joe could get on the phone and said, Netanyahu, we're not giving you any more arms if you don't stop. It's that simple. Now, for Kamala to say unwavering, that's one of the adjectives they use, unwavering support for Israel for the defending itself. So it has to kill upwards of 40,000. Some people say close to 200,000. Palestinians, not Hamas, but Palestinians, to defend itself? Give me a break. I'm not stupid, Kamala. I don't believe that. And worse still, you're lying. Now, you may not know that you're lying, but this made-up story about Hamas people raping Israeli women has been disproven definitively by the people in Israel who now admit it, and who Max Blumenthal and his crew have interrogated. And the New York Times has taken a step back. And not even the New York Times says that slander anymore. There was rape. The people who are raping are the Israeli soldiers now, and they're raping to a fairly well and not being held accountable for it. So now rape is a special genus of charge, because that's what they always use. It's the most heinous thing. I mean, that's how they captured Julian Assange, for God's sake. Spurious, undocumented, false charges that he raped two Swedish women. They didn't say he had raped them, but they got him on that charge. And how you defame somebody? Easy, charging with rape. So that bothers me. Now, what's happening with respect to the preparation for the November election reminds me of what happened in 2016 when the business about Russia was raised, and the Russiagate canard, the false story that the Russians had interfered with our election, came to the fore. Now, the reason I say that now is because it's coming to the fore again. People like Michael Isikoff, who is co-author of Russian Roulette, who repeated all the dossier business and the business about the prostitutes urinating on Trump when he was in Moscow and all that kind of thing. They got a big acclaim for that book, 4 stars in the New York Times, right? But it was all contrived. It was all completely made up. Guess who's coming to the fore now saying, aha, the Russians linked it, the Russians hacked into the election, and they'll probably do it again. Michael Isikoff. I have a little draft that will probably be published this week to expose that, to show how lots of people are able to reemploy these people despite the slander that they were guilty of initially, and sort of whip up animus against Russia. Now, people always, people ask me for, 8 years now, what do you get so upset about lies about Russia? I said, well, it prepares the American people. If Biden or Kamala or Trump decide they'd like to use a mini nuke or do something really outlandish against the Russians, the American people are so darn brainwashed. So darn brainwashed by the major media that they would mostly acquiesce in that and say, well, if they're evil, if Putin is Hitler, I mean, what Hitler was, we gotta go into the fray. So before the election, I expect to see more of Kamala using that kind of thing. I really was disappointed she trotted out the rape charge. She should know that she's vulnerable on that one. But is the New York Times going to say, well, no, we said that initially, but it wasn't true. So Kamala, don't say that again. No, they're not going to do that. The New York Times and most of the mainstream media are just as much in Kamala's camp as they were in Hillary's camp. This is not to say that Trump would be a good president. I'll go on record again as saying that he was, in my view, the worst, the very worst U.S. president we ever had. And that includes George W. Bush, who started an unnecessary war of aggression. So I hold no brief for Trump. I just hold a brief for telling the truth, for God's sake, and let the chips fall where they may, but at least don't mislead the American people to think that the Hamas invading Israel during that time, where they had a couple of hours in Israel, they took time. And now, wait a second, you do some guard duty here. I want to rape some of these women. I mean, give me a break. It didn't happen. People who were involved in it admit that it didn't happen. Why does Kamala, is that part of defending Israel's right to exist or defend itself, to spread lies like that? Well, unfortunately, people like Kamala must think that's the case. Unless somebody disabuses her of that, she'll keep propagating that kind of falsehood.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Ray, for being with us today. Great pleasure, as always.
You're most welcome, Nima.